And call the Senate Committee on Commerce to order. We have a pretty full agenda today. We're going to take some public testimony, possible work sessions on a number of bills. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 484. So I'll open a public hearing on 484. And Ms. Braun, why don't you get us an overview, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 484 makes contracts that contain mandatory arbitration clauses or clauses that prohibit enforcement through a civil action in Oregon courts an unlawful trade practice. There's no revenue impact on this bill. It may have a fiscal impact. The statement's not yet issued. That's all, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I'm going to call Dean Slack and William Brandt up first. Mr. Slack, this bill was introduced on your behalf through my office, and so I'm going to give you an opportunity to give us your presentation, and Mr. Brandt will let you follow, and we'll take it from there. And what I need y'all to do is give us your name before you give us your testimony. And the other thing I had asked is that for everyone that's giving testimony this afternoon, if you have written testimony, please do not read it word for word. We can and will take the time to review that material. What we need you to do is summarize because of the time restraints we have and the number of bills we have today. So, Mr. Slack, Dean, why don't you go ahead and go?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to make this presentation. About how much time do I have, would you say?
We'll let you know when you run it.
Okay, if I push the limit, you'll tell me.
Yeah, how much time are you contemplating?
15 to 20 minutes.
That's way too much.
Okay.
So you're going to need to narrow it down because we've got five different bills on today's schedule.
I can do that.
Okay. Thank you, Dean.
Yes. All right. 2 years ago, I went to an auto dealership in Eugene, Kendall Hyundai, and purchased a car after doing considerable research, and I got the car that I wanted. And then as I read the contract, and I got to the back of the contract, it had...
Dean, I need you to stop for a second and give us your name so it's part of the record.
Excuse me, Dean Schlecht.
All right, thank you.
When I looked at the contract before signing, I noticed on the back there was binding mandatory arbitration that blocked me from ever taking any civil action regarding any defects in the contract or problems with the car that could not be resolved. I mentioned at the time that was unacceptable to me. Would they strike that in order to maintain the sale? They would prefer not to sell me the car as opposed to giving up that clause in the contract. So that left me with the dilemma, do I want the car badly enough to take the risk of binding mandatory arbitration? I went ahead and did it, and it's a fine little car. But this alerted me to this issue. I had only been vaguely aware that there was such a thing. In looking at it, I found out that auto dealers themselves have struggled with this problem of binding mandatory arbitration. In the 90s and early 2000s, manufacturers were demanding binding mandatory arbitration of auto dealers, and they campaigned strongly in Congress to replace that. Their arguments against being forced into binding mandatory arbitration were, by placing an arbitration clause in this take-it-or-leave-it contract, the stronger party may impose mandatory arbitration on an unwitting or unwilling dealer. Another presentation. In fact, the process is so one-sided at any one time, the manufacturer can and does simply mail out an addendum that becomes part of the contract without any agreement or acceptance of the dealer. Another statement from dealers. Our out-of-pocket expenses alone were far in excess of the arbitrator's award. Another dealer statement. All of the people involved in the actual decision-making or administration of mandatory arbitration procedure owed their economic well-being to Saturn. And finally, another statement. Perhaps the most striking feature of the mandatory and binding arbitration is the fact that arbitrators are not required to follow state law or precedent, and no remedy is available if the law is misapplied. Because of making these statements before the Congress, a law was enacted that made it illegal for automobile manufacturers to demand binding arbitration with automobile dealers. The automobile dealers then went home and devised binding mandatory arbitration for all of their customers. I did some shopping around in Eugene because my faithful old Volvos are making funny noises, and I could not find a dealership that didn't have binding mandatory arbitration written into its contract. And when I asked them, well, would you waive that? Every one of them said, absolutely not. Now, I didn't check with BMW or Mercedes because that's not in my price range, but everybody else was unanimous. What I'm talking about here is not voluntary arbitration, which is a wonderful process that relieves the courts of congestion and sometimes resolves issues simply. What I'm talking about is binding mandatory arbitration. It affects consumers in a wide variety of ways. First off, consumers are often unaware that they've agreed to binding arbitration or that they've waived their civil rights. I'm not sure how many people bother to read the fine print in contracts as I did. It severely limits consumer options for resolving a dispute. It binds the consumer, not the dealer or not the corporation, frequently. There are no consistent rules, procedures, precedents, discovery, or appeal, such as would be available in a court system. This is arbitrary, and the rules are set up by the arbitrator. The corporation picks the arbitration company, which in effect is a judge, even though they don't need to have any kind of judicial training or legal training to perform that role. This leads to inevitable bias when the arbitration company's profits and even its survival is dependent upon its corporate customers. And it frequently costs more to go to arbitration for a consumer than it does to go to court. Where home mortgage and home repairs are being arbitrated, it costs $800 to $1,000 to initiate a case, and then it's $200 to $300 an hour in arbitrator's fees. That's very expensive for an ordinary consumer in the middle class. My experience with autos, however, this is a very widespread phenomenon. It doesn't just involve autos, but it involves the workplace, in which binding mandatory arbitration is called early dispute resolution, in which people waive their right for civil protection and discrimination and harassment issues, and arbitrators are allowed to make that decision. It involves health care, where insurance companies use it to stave off appeals. HMOs use it to protect themselves from malpractice. Nursing homes are using it more and more, and physicians are getting on board with it. So that in order to get the health care you need, you have to sign away your right to a civil response or a civil trial. It is strongly influencing home ownership. Mortgages are including binding mandatory agreements, and home repairs are including that as well. And frequently, the home repair arbitrators are choosing contractors to be the resource for doing the arbitration. And this always goes badly, almost always, for the consumer. It involves banking, credit cards, mortgages. If you get those little flyers with that tiny print with your credit card bill, it's a possibility that one of them came through that said you now are subject to binding mandatory arbitration, and if you make any further purchases with your card, that is considered an agreement, and you wouldn't even have noticed it, but you've done it. Two possibilities were presented as way of resolving it in Oregon. One is Senate Bill 484, which is a modification of the Untruthful Trade Practice Law, which simply says that mandatory arbitration is illegal in Oregon. Now, the Supreme Court has held that under the Federal Arbitration Act, mandatory arbitration clauses must be enforced despite state laws to the contrary. It's not clear to me if that would preclude a law outlawing them in the future, even though all the current ones would have to be enforced. Another possibility was a different version called 485, which was based on a, I forget the proper term, but anyway, an ideal bill written up by a public service group that tried to find a way around the Supreme Court, and it probably would sustain a legal challenge more readily. And it's based on a modification to contract law, and there's a copy of it in your folder if you're interested. Senator Patrick Leahy, who is, as you know, the current chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has expressed considerable concern about binding mandatory arbitration issues. He said, contracts that trick consumers into signing away their legal rights through binding mandatory arbitration clauses buried in the fine print are not the fair way to do business. He has in the past co-sponsored legislation to prohibit the mandatory clauses in credit card holder and car dealer contracts. And he goes on to say, it's an abuse that is quickly spreading, and it's time to blow the whistle and start giving consumers a break. I commend the coalition for shining a spotlight on this important consumer issue. What we are developing with this binding mandatory arbitration is a parallel legal system dominated by those who have power and money that is inevitably depriving consumers of their rights and lead to considerable injustices in the marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Brandt.
Thank you. My name is William Brandt. I am an attorney. I practice in Salem. A good portion of my practice has evolved into the area of representing people who have purchased business opportunities or franchises. I began to handle these cases in the mid-1980s when the contracts typically did not contain arbitration clauses or mandatory mediation clauses. And after a number of trials that went adversely to the companies that were selling business opportunities and franchises, I began to observe that these companies that were transacting business in Oregon, selling business opportunities and franchises to Oregon residents, were inserting not only mandatory arbitration clauses, but clauses that required the purchaser of the business opportunity or franchise to arbitrate or mediate their dispute, typically in the home state of the franchisor. This basically, for the most part, meant that people who had been defrauded ended up without a remedy because just the cost alone of litigating in a foreign forum was so prohibitive given the amount of the loss that most lawyers simply can't afford to do it, and most clients can't afford to do it. This basically resulted in the granting of a carte blanche license to many unscrupulous companies, and I'll name a few here, to foist off fraudulent business opportunities on unwitting people who are trying to better themselves, trying to develop a business for their family, knowing that it was a fraudulent business opportunity and knowing that there was going to be nothing they could do about it. A couple of examples of cases I'm working on now that had mandatory, in which the contracts have mandatory arbitration, would be I represent a group of Shell oil dealers that were terminated when Shell took over the ownership of a local oil company through a joint venture and immediately terminated the contracts of about 20 local operators. As has been pointed out, generally speaking, people do not even know that they have signed an arbitration agreement. They have no idea what it means. It's the language of the arbitration clause is usually on the back page, buried in it someplace. The cost to go to arbitration for these people, it's a three-panel arbitration through the American Arbitration Association. They want $40,000. The cost to file a complaint in Marion County Circuit Court, which we initially tried before we were sent to arbitration, is $206. These people, quite frankly, are having a hard time coming up with the $40,000 that the arbitrators want. And if they don't come up with it, the arbitrators have said their cases will be dismissed. And all of these families that lost their businesses through the oppressive act of a powerful oil company will basically have no remedy unless somebody is willing to put up the money, which is to help prosecute their cases. Another example is GNC stores, General Nutrition Centers. I've represented at least three people who were induced to invest in GNC stores. There have been national abuses by this company. GNC requires that you go to Pittsburgh to mediate first. If you're unsuccessful, and I've done that, and it's not a friendly or fair mediation forum, it's just a deterrent. And if you are unsuccessful in settling your case in mediation, then you have to arbitrate in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Again, for the last two people I had, they simply didn't even have the money to get themselves there, much less get a lawyer there or do it on a who would do it on a contingent fee basis. But at least the expenses were overwhelming. So this bill is critically important to protect the rights of Oregon consumers. It is in the best interest of the Oregon citizens. It will not deter business, these companies from doing business, because it's way more profitable for them to still do business and deal with the few cases. But it will provide access to justice for Oregon citizens who purchase franchises or business opportunities, and I hardly recommend that this bill be adopted because it's in the interest of the Oregon public to do so.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our next panel is going to include Patrick Wade, Jim Gardner, and Harlan Levy. Patrick, we'll let you start off.
Thank you, Chair Pazowski and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Wade, and I'm here as a representative of the Oregon State Bar Debtor-Creditor Section. Debtor-Creditor Section represents interest both of debtors and creditors in the practice of law in the state of Oregon. Again, as the chairman requested, I'll abbreviate my remarks here, but the main thrust of our section's concern with this bill is that it would have a tendency to reduce the opportunities for participation by Oregon residents in national business. The bill, as drafted, would apply not only to consumer but also to all commercial transactions. In fact, it's difficult to imagine any contract, or at least to which the bill would not apply. we believe that this bill would be a trap for the unwary out-of-state business and would have a negative effect on Oregon commerce. Just as an example, the American Land Title Association standard policies include an arbitration clause. Enactment of this bill would eliminate the availability in Oregon of the national uniform land title policies, most likely. It would also have an effect on the ability of national financial institutions to participate in the mortgage market and other things of that nature. I think that the bill goes too far in making this an unlawful trade practice as distinguished from merely making an arbitration clause unenforceable. The consequent liability to the unwitting national business concern and accidentally including an arbitration provision in an Oregon contract is not warranted. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
All right, thank you. Jim, why don't you go next?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today somewhat unexpectedly, I must say, for Microsoft. I had not originally intended to testify or weigh in on this bill. This is not a bill that really affects Microsoft specifically or even the software industry generally. And the reason I'm here is because I received a call this morning from representative of the Oregon University System just saying, I want to give you a heads up. There may be some unintended consequences to Senate Bill 484, and those consequences include the fact that we may not be able to do business with your company or other vendors to the Oregon University system under enterprise agreements that include arbitration clauses. I said, you've got to be kidding me. And as I began to, I'm not an arbitration law expert that my colleague here at the stand is, but as I began to probe this a little bit, it became quite clear that we're dealing with a bill that indeed may have a whole array of unintended consequences, in large part because this applies with full force to commercial transactions between commercial entities in addition to transactions with individual consumers. And in that context, we're talking here, just to use the system of the example of the state system of higher education, Oregon University system, sophisticated procurement people and sophisticated legal experts on both sides who know full well what it means to sign a contract with a mandatory arbitration clause. It's no mystery to them what the implications of that are. The other area where these types of clauses are ubiquitous, practically the rule, is in contracts involving foreign commerce, where, for instance, an Oregon company is exporting to Japan or Europe or wherever it may be, either equipment or software or agricultural products or whatever, they will routinely put in those contracts a mandatory arbitration clause. And the reason is that neither the domestic seller, the Oregon company, doesn't want to have to sue in the District Court of Bombay if something goes wrong with that contract, and neither does the purchaser want to have to defend itself in Multnomah County Circuit Court. They opt routinely for an arbitration panel under the rules of arbitration. It's been a long-term goal, I think, of the judicial system the legal profession, led by such luminaries that some of you may know, the late, great, departed Sid Lezak, prominent among them, to really move toward alternative dispute resolution, in part to ease the burden, the financial burden on the court, but also because contrary to some of the stories that you've heard to date, particularly in the commercial context, arbitration tends to even out the edges. The arbitrators tend to gravitate toward the middle. They don't like to have an extreme result over here. Big winners or big losers, they kind of gravitate toward the middle. And that's why in the commercial context in particular, it's become increasingly the norm. So I would just wanted to alert you to this bill has very, very broad commercial implications beyond the sort of core concern that have been voiced of consumer protection.
Harlan?
Thank you, Chair Krasanski, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I am here to oppose Senate Bill 484. We're very concerned about this bill. Most of the real estate transactions, residential real estate transactions that occur within the state of Oregon use a form which contains a mandatory arbitration clause for disputes between the buyer and seller. We find that this is much less costly, much less time-consuming, and a much more flexible way to resolve those disputes than going through the judicial system. So we are very concerned about this bill. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, I'm going to ask each of you the same question, or just let me summarize to make sure what I'm hearing. One of the concerns is that the bill currently requires it to be treated as unfair trade practice as compared to being maybe an unenforceable clause within the contract itself. And if we made that change, that would give a different light from the OSB's perspective. Mr. Wade?
I believe that's correct, although the committee reviewing this bill, of course, is looking at the bill as drafted. There was some discussion that the opinion would probably be different if the bill only provided for unenforceability as opposed to inclusion as an unfair trade practice.
All right. And Mr. Gardner and Mr. Levy, regarding your concerns, it seems like it's, let's say, as it's currently drafted, too broad. Because it takes in commercial type of contracts between, let's call it commercial individuals or organizations, and should be limited, if it was going to move forward, to consumer contracts on consumer goods.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, that's the, I think, the unintended consequence that I wanted to draw to the committee's attention.
Mr. Chair, Harlan Levy for the record. Our concern is that it applies to real estate. So if it was real estate was removed from the bill, I don't know that we would have an opinion about it.
All right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, at some point I'd like to know what other states have done with regard to this issue. You know, are we out in front of the wave, or are we just riding the wave?
All right. Thank you, Senator. Our trustee committee assistant will get back to all of us on that. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Julie Brandis, Bill Cross, Daryl Fuller.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller for the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association, and we're here to oppose the bill not on its technicalities but on its merits. We believe that binding arbitration clauses in consumer contracts are beneficial not only to the seller but to the buyer. I was with a group of dealers in Eugene at lunch, which is actually part of the reason why I arrived here a little bit late. And when I mentioned this bill to them, they were a little surprised because the state was the organization that sort of encouraged us to put binding arbitration clauses in our contracts, because they were looking for ways to get cases out of the court system and look for other alternatives because the court systems were so bogged down. And so the state has a dispute resolution commission. My wife has a certificate in dispute resolution from Willamette University. Dispute resolution is, for a few years, was the most popular thing that everybody was encouraging businesses and consumers to participate in. We found that most people prefer binding arbitration on both sides of an agreement until they actually have a problem, and then usually the person that loses doesn't like binding arbitration anymore, while the person who prevails does. And that sometimes benefits the consumer and sometimes it benefits the dealer. But we do not believe that there's any evidence to indicate that binding arbitration is to the benefit of one side of the equation or the other. It is simply an alternative way to mediate a dispute, and we don't believe that that sides on business as opposed to consumers. And we believe that consumers should still have the option of signing a contract that includes binding arbitration if they prefer to do so. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Why don't we take the panel and hold that question, because I've got one too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. I think you've heard in general concerns from the broader business community. We're concerned about the broad implication that legislation has, as it has very broad provisions. It does impact the contracts between business-to-business relationships. Mr. Chair, you asked a question about, you know, could we support this if this only related to business-to-consumer relationships, and I can answer that question from our point of view that probably would not alleviate our concern, because we have national contracts. We generally do a similar contract for every consumer. It doesn't have to do with where the consumer might live. And finally, you know, in terms of arbitration, you know, I think Mr. Fuller has said some interesting points about that there are benefits to arbitration, and it's been my experience that when you have an arbitration clause or when you are forced into arbitration, generally you don't have as big as winners and big as losers. It's sort of, I think the term mediation means you pull to the middle and you find common ground. And that's a good thing, especially if we are not impacting the already compressed court systems that we have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Building Owners and Managers Association. And BOMA also opposes the bill in its current form. The commercial building real estate transactions, almost all of the contracts and agreements have a binding arbitration or mediation provision in them. I think you heard earlier about some of the other real estate from one of the other testimonials that the parties are generally pretty sophisticated, often represented by attorneys, and they have opted for the arbitration process because as a dispute resolution process, it generally results in faster, more economical decisions, faster decisions occurring, and in real estate, that's important to get closure as soon as possible. So from our perspective, we are concerned with Senate Bill 484. I know the question about unenforceable provisions would be perhaps a better remedy, that would be our position. Frankly, though, in terms of commercial real estate or real estate transactions, we don't see it as a necessity because we really are unaware of problems with the current dispute resolution process for real estate transactions.
Senator Monroe, you'd like to ask your questions?
Yeah, the question, we heard testimony that in some of these binding agreements, people were required to go to another state for arbitration. Would you be opposed to restrictions that said in cases of binding arbitration on transactions that take place in the state of Oregon, that the arbitration shall take place in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, on behalf of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association, we wouldn't have a problem with that.
Thank you.
That's your only question?
That's my only question.
Darrell, let me follow up with that. Oh, did someone else want to say something?
Oh, I wasn't sure if he was asking the question of each panelist.
Yes. Well, that'd be fine.
Mr. Chair, I would have to go back and ask the membership about that, but would be happy to put a request out on our leading issues.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure we wouldn't object at all.
All right. Darrell, I want to follow up on that question. Following up, besides just being within the state, but how about within the county of where the contract was entered? So, in other words, if someone's buying a car, as you used an example in Eugene, requiring that binding arbitration occurred within the county of purchase or the county of the county of purchase where the contract is entered, that way it would be maybe, quote-unquote, more fair to both sides. I could see where you could have someone come in from eastern Oregon maybe to buy a car in the valley or a truck in the valley, and it may not be fair for the business to go out to Pendleton or someplace.
Or Fossil.
Or John Day.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. If the arbitration had to occur in the county in which the purchase was made, we probably wouldn't have a problem with that. All that tends to support the business over the consumer, because then you're requiring the consumer to travel. My only concern about that in terms of potential unintended consequences, if you end up in a location where there isn't an arbiter available, then you're going to be... somebody's going to have to bear the cost of bringing an arbiter from Multnomah or Marion or Lane County to Lake County or to Malheur County in order to arbitrate it, and that might be end up being more expensive if that arbiter wants to be paid by the hour while they're driving, and it could be cost prohibitive in some cases. I certainly like the idea, and I don't have a problem with that. I would just be concerned that we make sure that we don't increase the cost of that arbitration to such a point that it becomes less valuable to the people participating in it. But I don't have a problem with the direction you're heading, certainly.
All right. And, Julie, if I could ask you, I know that you said that you'd have to go back to talk to your clients. My concern would be based on the testimony you already heard, and you're talking about national contracts. I'd be very curious to find out on those national contracts, where do they require arbitration to occur? Is it in some other state? Or is it in the state of where the transaction takes place?
Mr. Chair, I'll look into that and get back to you.
All right. Any other questions for anyone on the panel?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 484? With no one else
running of the table. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 484, and we're going to go ahead and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 559. And when Ms. Braun gets here, we'll go ahead and go over 559 for a work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 559 eliminates the references to guarantee contracts and substitutes workers' compensation insurance policy as a method of proving workers' compensation coverage. We heard this bill on February 26th. We had several people testify in favor, and we had no opposition. The testimony in favor was from Liberty Northwest and Farmers Insurance and Department of Consumer Business Services. There's a dash two amendment, and I would speak to the dash two if the chair would like.
Please.
The dash two amendments requires insurers to notify employers about non-renewed workers' compensation insurance policies. It clarifies that the director may require electronic transmission of data for proof of coverage information and restores references to surety bonds. It has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, and I believe there is a representative from Department of Consumer and Business Services to answer questions if the committee has questions.
All right, committee, this is a bill that we've had, and chair's comfortable with it based on the amendments. My understanding, the individuals that were participating in those amendments have agreed to them. Is that correct? And so, Senator Beyer, if you wanted to make a motion on the dash two amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments in the Senate Bill 559.
Senator Beyer moves the dash two amendments in the Senate Bill 559. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 559 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 559 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? It will be ordered. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 559. And who would like to be carrier? And Senator Beyer will be our carrier. All right, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing now on Senate Bill 946. And Sybil Hebb, why don't you go ahead and come on up? Understand that you're going to, and I know that Senator Brown is also going to be joining us maybe around the 4 o'clock time, so we'll get her in. And
Senator Monis Anderson will also be joining us.
Okay, and we have another senator that's supposed to be coming down.
And Dan Gardner.
And Dan, why don't you go ahead and come on up now? And looking to see who else we've got here. I got Tony Ryan on the witness list, and it says Tony lives more than 100 miles away. Can you tell where you?
From Ben.
And Ben? All right. Let's see. I think we've got room for you. Why don't you come on up? And, Ms. Braun, why don't you go ahead and give us the overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 946 requires employers to grant unpaid leave for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact of this bill. I got a message from Fiscal today. We don't have a statement yet, but the statement is expected to be minimal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Sybil, why don't you go ahead and give us the start on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center in support of Senate Bill 946. I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Law Center, which is a civil legal services provider, but also on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women, which is a statewide grassroots network of domestic violence and sexual assault advocates. I thank you so much for your time today and for your consideration of this bill, which is important to us because we perceive it as a bill that will protect people who are suffering from domestic violence and sexual assault and allow them to take steps to protect themselves while they are also able to remain employed. We know that economic self-sufficiency and economic resources and stability are vital to a victim's ability to maintain safety once she takes steps to get safe. And so the link between employment and maintaining employment and fostering a survivor's choices in seeking safety is a vital one. We believe that employers have a remarkable role to play, a remarkable opportunity in addressing this public safety and public health problem that is that Oregon is suffering from, similar to the problems around the nation. And if Oregon passes this bill, it will be the 10th state in the nation to have such a law. There are 12 other states that have legislation pending providing similar relief, and there are a number of counties and other jurisdictions that have passed such protection. I will summarize my comments about the policy and then move to an explanation of the bill. Generally, in terms of the policy, we think that without this protection, victims may postpone taking the steps that they need to take in order to get safe for fear that they will lose their jobs. As an attorney at Legal Aid, we unfortunately have seen examples of circumstances in which we have been representing victims in restraining order cases, for example. And our clients have told us halfway through the process, I simply can't come any longer. I can't take any more time off. And we've seen them drop out. We try to intervene and to negotiate that. Sometimes we're successful. Often we are. But there are times when we have not been successful and there has not been a remedy, and our clients were left without protection we felt they deserved. So I think that by fostering victims' abilities to take these steps, we're helping them to stay safe, helping them to protect their families, and also helping employers to facilitate the maintenance of safe employment spaces, both for those individual employees but also for other people who are coworkers who may also suffer from the impact of violence if it's not stopped. With that, I will summarize the bill if the committee so chooses, I don't know if you'd like me to. I can go through the provisions of the statute as proposed. I can hit the highlights.
Yeah, I'm just debating on how much we need you to go in detail. And we've got somewhat of an overview already. I'm going to ask you to give us the highlights, because we've got two senators that are going to probably give us some testimony, and I know Mr. Gardner will give us perspective as to the mechanics from Boley.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. The highlights are that the bill is modeled after current Oregon law that already allows victims to take time off to attend criminal proceedings. This bill provides the same structure for relief in this context so that victims can take immediate safety steps. Leave is only allowed for 5 purposes that are described clearly in the statute: seeking legal or law enforcement help, seeking medical or licensed health care professional counseling, seeking services from a crisis center such as safety planning services and counseling, or relocating to a safe location or securing a current home. We looked at legislation across the states and determined that those were the 5 key ingredients and put them into this bill. In order to be eligible for the relief, the victim must provide certification of his or her eligibility if requested by the employer. And certification is detailed as being either a copy of a police report or a copy of court or other protective order evidence, documentation from an attorney, a medical counselor, a law enforcement officer, a clergy member, or a victim service provider. And certification is required to be kept confidential. There are enforcement provisions that I'll let Mr. Gardner speak to. We do believe that the bill provides protection to employers in that there is an exception that allows an employer to limit the leave that's authorized if it would provide an undue hardship to the employer. Time off is unpaid under this bill. It's reasonable in length according to the need that's shown. The smallest employers are exempt, and the employer may allow the employee to take accrued vacation leave or other leave that's in lieu of vacation leave, but the employer may determine in what order that leave should be taken. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Dan, why don't you go ahead and go next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'm pleased to be here today in support of Senate Bill 946. Senate Bill 946 really will allow victims of domestic or sexual violence or stalking to take reasonable unpaid time off from work to pursue protective orders or to redress the impact of the violence. Domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking are serious public health and safety issues in Oregon. And the statistics are staggering. In 2004, more than 85,000 women were physically or sexually assaulted by a current or most recent partner in the preceding 5 years. Each year, approximately 18 Oregonians are killed as the result of intimate partner violence. One in six Oregon women have been a victim of forcible rape. Without economic resources, victims cannot achieve the safety for themselves and their children. Economic independence is a primary indicator of whether a victim will be able to maintain safety from abuse. Victims are sometimes unable to leave work to obtain protections for fear of being fired. It's a good public policy to help reduce domestic and sexual violence by enabling victims to seek safety for themselves, their children, without losing their jobs. Allowing the victim to take steps to get safe also reduces the danger and stress to other employees in the workplace. Failure to address domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking in the workplace does impose significant costs on businesses. It's estimated that the intimate partner violence cost employers in Oregon approximately $9.3 million in lost productivity according to a 2005 survey. It also allows victims reasonable time to allow them to protect themselves, stop the redress of violence, and to get back to work. This bill is fair to employers. It provides provisions in the bill for clauses for undue hardship where the employers may opt out. Time off is unpaid for the employee, although they may use accrued leave, and it must be a reasonable length of time. Victims have to provide verification for the eligibility of relief, and as was said earlier, nine states have passed similar laws. The state of Maine passed a similar law in 2000. In Maine, the Chamber of Commerce supported expansion of the law because it's good public policy, and there were no concerns of implementation, and there's no evidence of abuse in those states. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bottom line is that victims should not have to choose between their jobs and their safety. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Tony?
Good afternoon. Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Toni Ryan. I'm the executive director of the Central Oregon Battering and Rape Alliance, is also known as COBRA. It's a victim services agency in Bend. We serve Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties. So we see about 350 women and children in our shelter each year, although we see a total of 7,000 individuals, whether it's in our support groups or peer counseling and such. And I'm here to talk about in favor of Senate Bill 946. This bill is of particular interest to me because we do serve victims in rural Oregon, in semi-rural Oregon. Bend is quickly changing. But a lot of what we see in the area are women who are working in the service industry. A lot of them are waitresses or work in motels, store clerks, that sort of thing. And they don't have the protections that perhaps a professional woman is. I'm sure all of you are familiar with some of the dynamics of domestic violence that can happen to anybody. But the women particularly that we're seeing that are coming through the shelter or accessing our services are desperately holding on to their jobs to begin with. If they're in a domestic violence situation, they're greatly challenged to hold on to their job, as they might be getting harassing phone calls at work. They might not be able to leave home for that day to go to work. They might have somebody showing up at work harassing the boss. So they might have a tenuous job to start with. If they go to seek protection and get out of that abusive situation, one of the first steps is to get a restraining order. They have to show up in court to get that restraining order. The judges don't work after 5. They don't make appointments. Even to see a victim service provider, that we aren't staffed 24/7, so that we also are pretty much Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. So this bill would really serve all victims of domestic violence, but particularly the ones that we see through COBRA. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel?
Mr. Chair?
Well, first I got Senator Beyer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if Sybil or Commissioner Gardner, who would be the best person to answer this question, or if it would be Senator Brown, if she's going to come down later. But I guess just some questions. First of all, is there a definition someplace in statute of what would be reasonable time off for employment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'd have to research that to see if there is. It could be easily done by administrative rule if there's not.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I do have a couple additional questions as we go on. So that would be my next question. Who would enforce it? Would it be the Bureau of Labor and Industries that would write administrative rules to define what reasonable leave is, or and who would enforce the provisions of the act?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the Bureau of Labor and Industries enforces all of the state family leave laws, so we would be the ones doing any administrative rules or enforcing the act.
And a couple more, I guess, Mr. Chair. Under undue hardship, it says significant difficulty and expense to a covered employer's business. Is that defined anywhere?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, undue hardship is in case law, and it's very well defined.
Could you give us some examples of what would constitute a significant difficulty and expense? And also, then under sub 2 of section 4, a covered employer may limit the amount of time of leave. Do we know under what lengths of time, even what rights would the employer have to limit the amount of time and to what degree?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that would have to be defined in administrative rule, but it would be basically based upon what would be the normal amount of time for the situations enacted within the legislation, and that would have to be defined.
I guess my last question on, at least for right now, would be under Section 6, it says, notice under the Notice of Employer section, it says, unless given advance, giving the advance notice is not feasible. Again, what would, when would not advance notice be unreasonable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think it would depend on the circumstances, but for example, if someone were assaulted overnight and was supposed to show up at 8 o'clock in the morning the next morning, but instead she was advised by the law enforcement officer to go to the courthouse and get a restraining order that morning, they may not have access to their employer to give that advance notice, but the bill would assume and require that she contact or give notice as soon as feasible. So if it's something that would be, I have an appointment to meet with my counselor at the victim services office at 4 o'clock, then clearly that's something that could be set up in advance and someone could give notice about that. But in an emergency circumstance, then advance notice wouldn't be feasible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess there's one final thing, and I don't know if you're planning on moving the bill today or not, but if you are, I'd like to have some of these issues brought forward for the record, as so if and when it gets to administrative rules, there is a legislative record as to what is would be acceptable to us as what would be reasonable and what would be significant difficulty and expense, and what would be a reasonable amount of or reasonable reasons to limit the leave. Those things, I think, would need to be build some legislative history on that as to guide the rulemaking process.
All right, Senator. We'll come back to that in a minute. Senator Gordley.
I did want to inquire of the chair whether it is your intent to move the bill.
I haven't made that decision yet.
Okay. Well, let me just offer this as by way of comment. I'm very pleased to see the bill before us. Embedded in the bill is good public policy. I'm reflecting on my experience over 30 years ago serving as a volunteer rape victim advocate in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I see this as a victim's rights public policy piece. Long overdue. For women who've been traumatized by sexual assault, by any form of domestic violence, they're dealing with months and years of trauma, trying to put their lives back together, post-traumatic stress. This is a step toward helping women and other victims of domestic of violence, including children, put their lives in order. So I would encourage us to do whatever we need to do to dot the I's, cross the T's, get this done. Again, reflecting on my experience some 30 years ago, it's amazing it's taken this long to get to this discussion in this process about this issue and to put something in place that does address the needs and rights of victims.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Senator Monroe.
Domestic violence is an epidemic in our nation. In fact, I've read that the number two cause of death for women under 50 is being killed by their domestic partner. Some of those domestic partners then turn the gun on themselves and kill themselves. Some of them get put in jail, and some of them, like a particular football player, go scot-free. I support this bill.
Mr. Chair, if I could make one more comment, it would be my intention concerning Senator Byer's question, is when we have to set up something for rulemaking process and for defining some of these terms, is to put together an advisory committee of broad-based business groups along with advocates for the bill to come up with reasonable solutions.
All right. Wait one second. Senator Bakken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For you, Mr. Commissioner, I mean, this is unquestionably a necessary and a very, very good bill to protect victims of abuse. But I think it's also a bill to protect employers. One of the most difficult thing for employers to be dealing with is somebody who is in crisis and doesn't have the ability to be able to get themselves and their life in order, and things drag on for days or weeks or months. Very difficult for an employer. I'm wondering if you could make some comments for the record with regard to the benefits that the employers may have after this bill passes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Avakian, absolutely. There are tremendous benefits. As I said in my testimony, you know, there are figures that show that this costs in Oregon businesses between $3 and $4 million a year in lost productivity. Because oftentimes you can run across situations where you have, an employee who is stalked or who is harassed at work, several phone calls, visits to the work site from a domestic partner that absolutely distracts from the workplace. It distracts not only the employee in question who's the victim of the abuse or stalking, but those all around them. And there are cases, and it has happened here in Oregon, where a spouse or a domestic partner has come, and actually there's murders that have taken place in the workplace. And it's unbelievable cost to a business, both personally and financially, when, you know, incidents of actual violence take place in the workplace. You know, I think it's incumbent upon every business out there to be able to take care of their employees, not only those that are victims of this, but others who could be collateral damage when something like that happens, to make sure that they're safe in the workplace and that everyone's productive and in their best situation to be productive in that business.
Thank you, Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know, Commissioner, if you assume you have administrative rules that relate to the leave to attend criminal proceedings section of the law now, and I would assume, I guess, that these rules would probably be very similar because the language is very similar. If you could provide a copy of that to at least me, or at least give me the reference so I can get it myself, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and call Senator Lori Montes Anderson and Senator Brown up.
Good afternoon, committee members. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown represent a little bit of Northeast Portland, a lot of bit of Southeast Portland, and the city of Milwaukee. My apologies if I repeat anything that the prior panel said. I was triple booked this afternoon, so things are a little crazed right now. Appreciate the committee giving its attention to Senate Bill 946. I feel like this is a really important bill. Stems out of my interest in the domestic violence arena, but also out of personal experiences and information that I've had in the last couple of years. 2001 session, we passed Senate Bill 610, allowing families of crime victims to attend court proceedings without fear of losing their jobs. This builds on the work that we did then to allow victims to take time off work to get stalking orders or protective orders that they need to protect themselves from domestic violence. I had an experience in the 04 interim getting a stalking order myself. A fellow who had been repeatedly visiting me, he had threatened to kill me in a prior session and felt very strongly that I needed to get a stalking order, despite the fact that I'm a lawyer, despite the fact that I had did practice family law. Thankfully, it was a did practice family law and knew the people in the system. It was still just difficult to arrange the schedule to make it happen. And I just think that this is a minimal amount of time that we can give folks that need these orders to protect themselves. The other circumstances I'm aware of, I had a friend practicing in the DA's office down in Lane County. She was prosecuting a domestic violence case, and that was before we allowed unemployment leave for victims of domestic violence. And the victim of that particular case was killed on her way to work. And so very concerned about workplace safety and believe this adds to this. This particular bill, will it solve the problem that happened most recently in Washington? No. Will it solve all of these crimes? No. But I think it's incumbent upon us as legislators, as policy makers, to give the victims of domestic violence every tool possible so that they become survivors of domestic violence. So I encourage your support and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Montes-Anderson from the Greshamwood Village, Troutdale, and Fairview area, and I truly believe that this legislature cannot wait to have workplace leave for victims of violence. We truly understand that victims are sometimes unable to seek the protection because they are of the fear of being fired. Also, domestic violence and sexual assault and stalking are really serious public health and safety issues that occur here in Oregon, and it is really in the public interest to reduce this violence by enabling the victims to seek safety and redress the effects of violence without jeopardizing their economic security. We know that economic independence is a primary indicator of whether a victim will be able to maintain safety from abuse. And I had my staff look up to see what has happened just this week, and let me tell you what's happened. An Atlanta man fatally shot his ex-girlfriend yesterday, at the CNN Center complex in downtown Atlanta, Georgia, before being shot by a security officer. This was at her place of work. And I want to give you a little bit of facts about the University of Washington campus in Seattle on Monday. This was Monday. Rebecca Grigo, she was a 26-year-old University of Washington researcher, was shot to death in her office Monday morning by her ex-boyfriend, who then turned the gun on himself. In the last weeks of her life, Rebecca took drastic steps to avoid her ex-boyfriend with threats of violence, and it made her fear for her life. She applied for and was granted a restraining order that required her ex-boyfriend to stay 500 feet away from herself, her residence, and her dog. She changed her cell phone number, and she moved. Then in early March, she sought a restraining order and told her coworkers about her fear of him threatening her. She posted his picture around her office so that coworkers could identify him if he showed up to stalk and harass her at work. And she did this because her ex-boyfriend was calling her at work at least twice a week with death threats, and coworkers said this left her visibly shaken on several occasions. Court records show that Rebecca was granted a temporary restraining order on March 6, saying that her ex-boyfriend has threatened her, her family members, and her dogs, and she also detailed physical violence and emotional abuse, as well as threats of more violence and death threats. Rebecca's boss at the University of Washington told reporters on Monday that she was left helpless and very frustrated because nobody would intervene until something happened. She did everything that a person in her situation could have done other than leaving her job. I think this is something that we need to really look at. It happened just a few hundred miles away from here, and I know that we have had deaths in Portland that I remember of several years ago. And so, again, I don't think this is something that we need to mess around with. We need to just go forward, pass it, and make it law. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of the senators?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Senator Brown, and perhaps you can help refresh my memory, you said the
leave to attend criminal proceedings happened in 2001?
I believe, I'm sorry, I didn't, what did you?
The leave to attend criminal proceedings, you said that was 01?
I believe it was 01. I think it was Senate Bill 610.
Okay, I'm looking at the statute book and it's saying 03, but but in 99 I was sure that we did some, at least in the House, did something that I can't find anywhere. Do you remember, because in 99 you were in the Senate and I was in the House.
Thankfully.
Okay.
Just kidding.
I was in the House with
But do you remember in 99, is that, because I was thinking that's
in terms of leave for crime victims?
I thought it was something like this, but it's...
The issue that I know we struggled with for at least two sessions was unemployment compensation for victims of domestic violence. And I can't remember those years.
That may be what it was.
99, maybe that, 99 that may, and 01. Okay, that that's what I'm getting from nods in the audience. And I can't even tell you the bill number, so.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one more question. I recognize that this bill copies the leave to attend criminal proceedings as far as the size of the employer at 6. The other Family Leave Act we have is for 25 and more employees. Any discussion as to about what is, you know, is if this... what's the right number of employees to qualify? Because, you know, for an employer of 6, loss of an employee is a lot bigger hardship than for an employer of 25 or more.
I totally agree, and having been in that situation myself, I'm very sympathetic about employers who have and small few employees who need to take time off. A couple of things what I would say, and that is the employee under the bill is required to provide verification to the employer. There is an undue hardship exemption for the employer, and I think the other piece is that the time off is unpaid. So I think given the comparison, the analogy with Senate Bill 610, 2001 or 2003, I think 6 is reasonable. If the committee feels like we need to move up, we're certainly willing to have that conversation. But
thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, so the chair was asked as to his intention. The intention of the chair is to move the bill today. What I do want to do is make sure we have some comfort here. First of all, I've got a witness registration list with 6 other people that want to give testimony and support. I have no one signed up in opposition to the bill. So with that said, we can continue to take testimony from those who want to give testimony, or the chair could stop the public hearing and go into a work session. So what I will do is I will call the names of the individuals here, and if you want to come up to give testimony, feel free to do so. If you choose to pass on that, realize that the chair's next intention is to go into a work session. So, Mel Cohn, Robert, is it Cannell, excuse me, and Alice, and I can't tell if it's Bartlett or Bartel.
No, I don't.
All right, Alice is waving. And Robert, Robert, did you want to come up and give testimony? Okay, please do. Mel? If you'd like to come up and give testimony, feel free to do so. And then Betty House. All right. And
Marsha Kelly,
I believe.
I have written testimony.
Okay.
And it includes resources for businesses, so you might want to look at that.
All right. And you're going to waive public? All right.
Just note that there are lots of resources for business.
Thank you. And the other person I have on here would be Jill Raquel or Rachel?
Rachel.
And did you want to give testimony today?
Yes.
Okay, please come on up. Gentlemen, whoever would like to start, go ahead and get started.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services, and I want to testify in favor of this bill. You've already heard the statistics about what a serious public health problem this is, and the purpose of my wanting to testify is simply to add my voice to that chorus and emphasize this. This is an issue which our office has been very involved with, collecting data on, and many of the statistics that you heard came from work that our office has done. So it's not right that a woman should have to choose between her job and her safety like this. And I think this is a very good public policy bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever would like to go next?
I'm Jill Rachel, and I want to support this bill. I am a social worker and a mental health therapist, but also I am a victim and survivor that continues to deal with this issue, and it's been going for many years. I have seen a lot of my clients come in who have been scared to go get a restraining order because they're afraid they're going to lose their job. They're afraid to get services because they're going to lose their job. And I tried very hard to work with them and say, how can we work this out? I think that this bill would support these people so that they can get the services and restraining orders and treatments and everything they need to get take care of business. I've also been a member of the Midway Business Association and presented how domestic violence works affects the workplace. The members of Midway Business Association and other guests that were there were very supportive of this type. I didn't bring up this bill, but supportive of this type of thing. They wanted to know how they could support a victim because they have seen this problem come into the workplace. They've had the perpetrator call or come into their business and be disruptive, and they wanted to know what they could do to help our victims and survivors. And these were small businesses. I'm not talking massive places, but local businesses. As a victim, I can tell you what it's like to have someone come to your work. It's really distracting. My ex-husband has come to my work. He has threatened people. He has called them names. He has been abusive mentally, emotionally to people I work with. And besides the fact that it's scary to me, it's also embarrassing. And I think that I now work for a place that I don't have to worry about that. They have done, put things in place. And still, I worry about him coming to get me. And this has been going on for many years. I mean, to the point where I moved from San Diego, California, up here to Oregon, and he followed behind me.
Mr. Chair, it is so important that we heard your voice today.
Yes.
Thank you for coming forward, and I honor the courage in your voice as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rob?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. my name is Rob Cannell, and I am, I guess, representing business on this particular panel. I work with American Family Insurance. I'm the state director for the state of Oregon. We are a very large mutual insurance company, third largest in the country, and we have over 8,500 employees in our company. One of the things I want to just testify about today is simply the cost to companies that domestic violence brings. I talked about Oregon, but in the country it's between $3 and $5 billion annually, including lost work, increased health care costs, high turnover, and low productivity. 16% of all employees are in a violent situation, and it causes issues for all of us. What happens in our workplace, as was mentioned earlier, sometimes people come to the workplace and they kill their victim, domestic violence victim. And that happened, as we've heard this week. There's a major issue for us. And I can tell you that we operate in most of the states that have already passed legislation similar to this. And we as a company have absolutely no issue with this legislation. In fact, we also believe that this is an issue that needs to be pushed forward. I also want to speak to you as a father of a 22-year-old daughter and a 21-year-old son who are both attending University of Oregon and will soon enter the workforce. And it concerns me that there are companies out there that do not provide this type of leave. And I just want to let you know that I believe that this legislation will have a positive impact on the lives of thousands of women and children in the state of Oregon, and I support it.
Right. Thank you. And I also want to thank everyone that's on the panel, and Jill, especially you being brave enough to come forward and put on the record your story, because it does give a human touch side. We hear from a lot of people that are advocates, as well as employers and such, which is very important, but it's also very important to hear from someone such as yourself who has had those experiences. So thank you for having the courage, as Senator Gordley has said, to come forward today. Is there any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. All right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 946, open up the work session on the Senate Bill 946. And the chair wants to just, have just a little dialogue. Senator Beyer had raised some issues as to wanting to make certain we had the parameters as to what would be setting legislative history and context for this bill. I would suggest that one of the things that we can do is if the bill moves forward at this time, we can set the record on the floor. I understand that you're wanting to get hold of some information, and maybe we can discuss those issues there on the floor to set some parameters. We did also hear from Commissioner Gardner as to the process that's contemplated as how this will be done through rulemaking using a body of individuals who would be, let's say, various interest groups and participants. So I'd like to give you an opportunity to state whatever you think we need to do or how we can best accommodate the concerns, if any, that you still have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After I read the statutory language of 669-190 through 198, which is the leave to attend criminal proceedings, the statutory language is fairly similar to this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to look at the administrative rules that were written for that, and I think you're correct. If we have issues or want to create a legislative record after I've seen those administrative rules, I think the floor would be the appropriate time to do that.
All right. Thank you. In that case, the chair will take a motion on Senate Bill 946 at this time.
So moved.
Go ahead.
Senator Gordley.
So moved.
And the motion that you're moving is?
To move Senate Bill 946 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
We have a recommendation, a joint recommendation from Senator Gordley and Senator Beyer moving Senate Bill 946 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any oppositions? Not being any, it's ordered. And we'll sign Senator Brown and Senator Montes Anderson to be the carriers of that bill. And if for some reason they don't want to do it, we'll talk to them and convince them that they should. All right. Thank you very much. And the humor is just to kind of lighten the load a little bit based on some of the testimony we heard. With that said, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 872. And I have a few people who want to give testimony on that. But before we call you up, all right, thank you. Ms. Brown, why don't you give us an overview, and then we'll call up the first three.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 872 allows a former spouse of a judge member of the public employee's retirement system as an alternate payee if the marriage lasted at least 1 year. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact. Statement that's not yet issued. There's a dash one amendment in the works.
All right, thank you. I've got two people that are signed up that are over 100 miles, and Robert Rosenthal, I understand that you need to be on the road sooner than later, so why don't you go ahead and come on up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown would testify also.
Can I just come up?
Yeah, and Stephen Reed, why don't you come up, and Senator Brown, you can join them.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown, in my former life, I did practice family law. I'm very fortunate not to have to practice family law at this point in time. But in that wonderful opportunity, I got to meet Gary Zimmer, who will also be testifying. Mr. Zimmer is a well-respected family law lawyer in Oregon and introduced this concept to me. I think it merits your attention. I believe there's no fiscal – I know there's no fiscal impact on the budget, and I believe that there's no impact on the PERS system. The amendment, the folks have worked out an amendment. I think everybody's in agreement on the amendment, so I'd ask for your support. Thank you very much.
All right, and if you're getting ready to take off, Senator Brown, did you say Gary or Gart? Because I was going to say Gart based on the handwriting.
Gary. It's Gary.
Okay.
Gary.
Well, of course, this looks like Gart.
Well, Mr. Chair, my connections with Mr. Zimmer, he's been extremely meticulous, so I'm surprised that his handwriting is not neater.
We're there. We've got it now. All right. Let's see. Robert, why don't you go ahead and go, because I'm not sure how long you have to stay if you got to get on the road.
Did you want to go first? Okay. My name's Robert Rosenthal. I'm a private attorney. I do work in the retirement benefits area. I've divided retirement benefits and divorce matters more than 2,000 Oregonians since 1985, including more than 100 public employees. When the legislature allowed former spouse benefits for state employees about 16, 17 years ago, they left out the ability for former spouses of judges to get such benefits. All other state employees can have their former spouse get a benefit. In the judge's plan, only a small account balance can be given to a former spouse. The principal benefit that a judge gets is a lifetime annuity, a payment every month for the rest of their life. They then have the right to give their former spouse a percentage of that. They have a further right to buy by reducing their lifetime benefit even a greater annuity, such as 80% to a former spouse. That benefit right now cannot be given to a former spouse. I support Senate Bill 872, along with the consensus amendment from our PERS attorneys and us, that would give this benefit to former spouses of judges, that would put it essentially on the same par as other state employees.
Thank you. And Stephen?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Reed. I'm a Columbia County Circuit Court judge. I'm the poster child of what did happen. I was divorced in 2003 after spending a lot of time and money. We found out that it simply could not be done. My judge PERS plan could not be divided by judgment order. And so we have a Band-Aid plan that requires me to pay cash when I get to that retirement age. Of course, I get to pay taxes on it, and she gets to pay taxes on it. Yeah, it's just a loophole that needs to get closed. And that's all I'm here for, gentlemen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your comments. Gary.
Thank you. I'm with the law firm of Zimmer & Bunch. I've been a lawyer since 1975. I've been doing family law, primarily divorces, since 1978. My partner, Peter Bunch, submitted a letter of March 30th, 2007 to Senator Rod Monroe, and copies for each of the members of this committee that summarize the issue and how the proposed legislation will address this legislative oversight. I am currently representing a judge who has been married for 20 years, and he's retired, and at the time of retirement, he and his wife chose to take a benefit of 80% so his wife could have the survivor benefit. Unfortunately, they're going through a divorce, and PERS said that it was their opinion that there would be no survivor benefit under the law for her because she would not be the surviving spouse at the time of his death. I'm here on behalf of Judge Moultrie, supportive of this legislation, because it's absolutely unfair to Ms. Moultrie to be married that long and not have the opportunity, when this is already in pay status, he's already paying the premium to give her the benefit out of his benefit, that it would be lost to her. What's interesting, and I learned this directly from PERS, is that if this law doesn't get changed, the benefit will go away for Ms. Moultrie, but they will continue to deduct the cost of the survivor benefit from Judge Moultrie's pension. And they're just absolutely, and we asked him, we said, how can you do that? And I said, that's just the way it goes. But we have, through Bob Rosenthal's efforts, there's a consensus now between PERS and all people supporting this to get this legislation put through, and we would ask for your support. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for any of the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. The last two people I have must be Lisa Moultrie and James, I believe, Richardson. Mr. Delaney, were you wanting to give testimony today? Just wanted to make sure we didn't exclude you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm James Richardson. I'm a lawyer in private practice of law since 1977. I'm in a firm now, DeBast, McFarland, and Richardson. We do primarily domestic relations law, and I represent the flesh and blood of this. You've heard the nuts and bolts. This is Lisa Moultrie, and she's a little nervous, so I'm going to ask her questions and get her testimony out that way, and it might be a little bit quicker, too. Ms. Moultrie, you're married to Judge Moultrie, right?
Yes, I am.
And he's retired.
All right, let's do this. I appreciate what we're doing here, but this isn't a court, so I don't feel real comfortable with that. What I'd like for you to do is go ahead and let Ms. Moultrie have a microphone.
Sure.
And Mr. Richardson, if you want to give us a little bit of history, that's fine. And Ms. Moultrie, we're not going to attack you or anything like that. What I want you to do is give you an opportunity, after you identify yourself, just tell us from your heart what is it that is the issues here for you, and how this type of legislation would impact your life, and as compared to cross-examination or question and answer. I'm sorry, I'm an attorney. I just have some rules as to not doing that in this type of proceeding.
Okay.
So, Ms. Moultrie?
My name is Lisa Moultrie, and I've been married to Tom Moultrie for 20 years. We were married in 1986. I became a stay-at-home mom after I left the law firm of Wetzlin DeFrang, where I worked. I raised two children during those years. Mr. Moultrie retired in 1999. And our children were still in high school. It was my understanding, hopefully, that after they had graduated high school, that perhaps I would go back to work, that I would have my own pension plan. That didn't happen. I have not put away any money in a pension plan. It wasn't in my budget, monthly budget, when raising my family and paying the bills. There was no other provision provided for any kind of separate pension. If I were to lose the benefit of this, I would have nothing. I don't have enough time left in my career to make enough money to form that size of a pension or even to get above minimum Social Security. I would be very, very poor old woman.
All right. Thank you very much for coming up and sharing from the heart. Mr. Richardson, did you have something else you'd like to add?
I'd just like to add a couple of things. Number one, she'd be a very poor woman for a considerable amount of time. Judge Moultrie is 18 years older than Ms. Moultrie, and women outsurvive us men by an average of 6 or 7 years, and that gap is increasing. So there's a long time that she's not going to be provided for in comparison with other surviving spouses that are divorced from the PERS system. This is a gap that needs to be closed. It's unfair to a particular group of people that just happen to be unlucky enough to have married judges.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for either on the panel? Again, thank you very much for coming forward. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 872? Not seeing anyone here? Yes.
I think I got a question for Mr. Delaney.
All right, Mr. Delaney, why don't you come on up? And just for the record, go ahead and put your name on the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Delaney, Deputy Director of Oregon PERS.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a couple questions. First of all, judges have a separate pension system than the normal PERS and everybody else has, don't they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, they are part of the PERS system.
Yes.
So they are members within PERS. There are specific provisions of the plan that apply to judge members.
Okay, and then just a little history, I guess. Why is it that this benefit to divorced or surviving spouses was not given to them 15, 16 years ago, whenever it was changed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, probably because of the later entry of judges into the PERS plan. Judges were merged into the PERS plan approximately 1991. I'm not positive of the year there. So you had a lot of history already in place with PERS, and judges merged into that with sort of their own provisions. Thus, they were encapsulated in Chapter 500 or Series 500 of PERS Chapter 238. So I'm not sure historically why that hadn't been in the judge plan, but when it merged with PERS, it did not take all the provisions of the existing PERS plan at that time.
Final question, I guess, is will this bill have any effect on the PERS system and increase or decrease of the unfunded liability we currently have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, no, it doesn't have an impact on cost in this sense. The actuaries assume that a judge will have a surviving spouse that will exist beyond that will live beyond the judge. And so that is what has been funded for. What you would have is avoided cost savings if currently in the system, if a judge has divorced and then dies without a surviving spouse. We assumed there would be a surviving spouse there. By not having one, that savings that you would have gotten otherwise, because there would in essence be less benefit paid out, would no longer default to the plan. So it does not have a cost because we assume the surviving spouse, but the possibility of having a savings would be reduced with this bill.
Brings up one more question. Judge gets divorced, I guess, after they've chosen the 80%, so they got the survivorship benefits. Judge then remarries. So now you've got this benefit being split. Judge remarries, then dies. You now have a beneficiary being paid to two surviving spouses. That won't add cost to the system?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, that's something we'd have to add by rule as to how that would work out, because we are unsure ourselves as to how that would actually work in that scenario, where you'd have a secondary surviving spouse now coming in place. Our assumption is, and this is the only assumption that the committee hasn't indicated, is that you probably have an accrued benefit up to the time of divorce, and so that benefit that was accrued during their marriage period would be paid to the individual designated as the surviving spouse. This, and then you'd have your new surviving spouse beginning to accrue benefits.
Right.
How we would actually lay that out, we'd still have to look at as far as through the administrative rulemaking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Right. Senator Monroe.
Would this bill treat judges exactly the same as teachers and other PERS recipients?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I have to pause to think on that. This is getting closer. First off, we will have some amendments to the bill. The amendments are meant to bring it closer to the way we actually treat members. In that scenario, my general sense is yes, Senator, but I'd caveat that with allow me to just double check with my staff. And the reason I caveat it is there are enough special features to judge benefits that differ from the general population, such as judges have a cap on their benefit that you do not have with regard to regular members. So judges cannot get more than 75% of their final average salary. So you have some special features there of judges that I can't give a direct answer without possibly misleading you. I need to meet with staff and get back to you on that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, but I'm a PERS recipient. If I divorced my wife, I could, in fact, leave her a portion of my PERS benefits as part of the divorce decree. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, that is correct.
And a judge can't do that?
For the judge member, that is not possible.
Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, or Mr. Laney, thank you for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 872 and understand that we do have amendments in the process. They are not made yet, or and since they're not completed. And so we will not be opening a work session on 872 today, but the chair does expect that once the amendments get out that we'll bring this back up for a work session. Any other questions from the panel? Not seeing any. We're adjourned for the day. Thank you.
Rod, I'm going to tell Billy she needs to start negotiating now.